Chapter 35 Continued. Harry did not have to think. There was no choice. The prophecy was hot with the heat of his clutching hand as he held it out. Malfoy jumped forwards to take it. Then, high above them, two more doors burst open and five more people sprinted into the room. Sirius, Lupin, Moody, Tonks, and Kingsley. Malfoy turned and raised his wand, but Tonks had already sent a stunning spell right at him. Harry did not wait to see whether it had made contact, but dived off the dais out of the way. The Death Eaters were completely distracted by the appearance of the members of the Order, who were now raining spells down upon them as they jumped from step to step towards the sunken floor. Through the darting bodies, the flashes of light, Harry could see Neville crawling along. He dodged another jet of red light and flung himself flat on the ground to reach Neville. "Are you okay?" he yelled, as another spell soared inches over their heads. "Yes," said Neville, trying to pull himself up. "And Ron? I think he's all right. He was still fighting De Braid when I left." The stone floor between them exploded as a spell hit it, leaving a crater right where Neville's hand had been only seconds before. Both scrambled away from the spot. Then a thick arm came out of nowhere, seized Harry around the neck, and pulled him upright so that his toes were barely touching the floor. "Give it to me," growled a voice in his ear. "Give me the prophecy!" The man was pressing so tightly on Harry's windpipe that he could not breathe. Through watering eyes he saw Sirius dueling with a Death Eater some 10 feet away. Kingsley was fighting two at once. Tonks, still halfway up the tiered seats, was firing spells down at Bellatrix. Nobody seemed to realize that Harry was dying. He turned his wand backwards towards the man's side, but had no breath to utter an incantation, and the man's free hand was groping towards the hand in which Harry was grasping the prophecy.
Ah!
Neville had come lunging out of nowhere. Unable to articulate a spell, he had jabbed Hermione's wand hard into the eyehole of the Death Eater's mask. The man relinquished Harry at once with a howl of pain. Harry whirled around to face him and gasped, "Stupefy!" The Death Eater keeled over backwards, and his mask slipped off. It was McNair, Buckbeak's would-be killer, one of his eyes now swollen and bloodshot. "Thanks," Harry said to Neville, pulling him aside as Sirius and his Death Eater lurched past, dueling so fiercely that their wands were blurs. Then Harry's foot made contact with something round and hard, and he slipped. For a moment he thought he had dropped the prophecy, but then he saw Moody's magical eye spinning away across the floor. Its owner was lying on his side, bleeding from the head, and his attacker was now bearing down upon Harry and Neville. Dolohoff, his long, pale face twisted with glee.
"Tarantalegra!"
he shouted, his wand pointing at Neville, whose legs went immediately into a kind of frenzied tap dance, unbalancing him and causing him to fall to the floor again.
"Now, Potter!"
He made the same slashing movement with his wand that he had used on Hermione, just as Harry yelled,
"Protego!"
Harry felt something streak across his face like a blunt knife. The force of it knocked him sideways, and he fell over Neville's jerking legs. But the shield charm had stopped the worst of the spell. Dolohoff raised his wand again.
"Axio prof!"
Sirius had hurtled out of nowhere, rammed Dolohoff with his shoulder, and sent him flying out of the way. The prophecy had again flown to the tips of Harry's fingers, but he had managed to cling on to it. Now Sirius and Dolohoff were dueling, their wands flashing like swords, sparks flying from their wand tips. Dolohoff drew back his wand to make the same slashing movement he had used on Harry and Hermione. Springing up, Harry yelled,
"Petrificus totalus!"
Once again, Dolohoff's arms and legs snapped together, and he keeled over backwards, landing with a crash on his back.
"Nice one!"
shouted Sirius, forcing Harry's head down as a pair of stunning spells flew towards them.
"Now, I want you to get out of..."
They both ducked again. A jet of green light had narrowly missed Sirius. Across the room, Harry saw Tonks fall from halfway up the stone steps, her limp form toppling from stone seat to stone seat, and Bellatrix, triumphant, running back towards the fray.
"Harry, take the prophecy! Grab Neville and run!"
Sirius yelled, dashing to meet Bellatrix. Harry did not see what happened next. Kingsley swayed across his field of vision, battling with the pockmarked and no longer masked Rookwood. Another jet of green light flew over Harry's head as he launched himself towards Neville.
"Can you stand?"
he bellowed in Neville's ear as Neville's legs jerked and twitched uncontrollably.
"Put your arm round my neck!"
Neville did so. Harry heaved. Neville's legs were still flying in every direction. They would not support him. And then, out of nowhere, a man lunged at them. Both fell backwards, Neville's legs waving wildly like an overturned beetle's. Harry, with his left arm held up in the air to try to save the small glass ball from being smashed.
"The prophecy! Give me the prophecy, Potter!"
snarled Lucius Malfoy's voice in his ear, and Harry felt the tip of Malfoy's wand pressing hard between his ribs.
"No! Get off me! Neville, catch it!"
Harry flung the prophecy across the floor. Neville span himself around on his back and scooped the ball to his chest. Malfoy pointed the wand instead at Neville, but Harry jabbed his own wand back over his shoulder and yelled,
"Impedimenta!"
Malfoy was blasted off his back. As Harry scrambled up again, he looked around and saw Malfoy smash into the dais on which Sirius and Bellatrix were now dueling. Malfoy aimed his wand at Harry and Neville again, but before he could draw breath to strike, Lupin had jumped between them.
"Harry, round up the others and go!"
Harry seized Neville by the shoulder of his robes and lifted him bodily onto the first tier of stone steps. Neville's legs twitched and jerked and would not support his weight. Harry heaved again with all the strength he possessed, and they climbed another step. A spell hit the stone bench at Harry's heel. It crumbled away, and he fell back to the step below. Neville sank to the ground, his legs still jerking and thrashing, and he thrust the prophecy into his pocket.
"Come on!" said Harry desperately, hauling at Neville's robes. "Just try and push with your legs!"
He gave another stupendous heave, and Neville's robes tore all along the left seam. The small, spun-glass ball dropped from his pocket, and before either of them could catch it, one of Neville's floundering feet kicked it. It flew some 10 feet to their right and smashed on the step beneath them. As both of them stared at the place where it had broken, appalled at what had happened, a pearly white figure with hugely magnified eyes rose into the air, unnoticed by any but them. Harry could see its mouth moving, but in all the crashes and screams and yells surrounding them, not one word of the prophecy could he hear. The figure stopped speaking and dissolved into nothingness.
"Harry, I'm sorry,"
cried Neville, his face anguished as his legs continued to flounder.
"I'm so sorry, Harry. I didn't mean to."
"It doesn't matter," Harry shouted. "Just try and stand. Let's get out of—"
"Dumbledore,"
said Neville, his sweaty face suddenly transported, staring over Harry's shoulder.
"What?" "Dumbledore!"
Harry turned to look where Neville was staring. Directly above them, framed in the doorway from the brain room, stood Albus Dumbledore, his wand aloft, his face white and furious. Harry felt a kind of electric charge surge through every particle of his body. They were saved. Dumbledore sped down the steps past Neville and Harry, who had no more thoughts of leaving. Dumbledore was already at the foot of the steps when the Death Eaters nearest realized he was there and yelled to the others.
One of the Death Eaters ran for it, scrabbling like a monkey up the stone steps opposite. Dumbledore's spell pulled him back as easily and effortlessly as though he had hooked him with an invisible line. Only one pair was still battling, apparently unaware of the new arrival. Harry saw Sirius duck Bellatrix's jet of red light. He was laughing at her.
"Come on, you can do better than that!"
he yelled, his voice echoing around the cavernous room. The second jet of light hit him squarely on the chest. The laughter had not quite died from his face, but his eyes widened in shock. Harry released Neville, though he was unaware of doing so. He was jumping down the steps again, pulling out his wand, as Dumbledore, too, turned towards the dais. It seemed to take Sirius an age to fall. His body curved in a graceful arc as he sank backwards through the ragged veil hanging from the arch. Harry saw the look of mingled fear and surprise on his godfather's wasted, once handsome face as he fell through the ancient doorway and disappeared behind the veil, which fluttered for a moment as though in a high wind, then fell back into place. Harry heard Bellatrix Lestrange's triumphant scream, but knew it meant nothing. Sirius had only just fallen through the archway. He would reappear from the other side any second. But Sirius did not reappear.
"Sirius!" Harry yelled. "Sirius!"
He had reached the floor, his breath coming in searing gasps. Sirius must be just behind the curtain. He, Harry, would pull him back out. But as he reached the ground and sprinted towards the dais, Lupin grabbed Harry around the chest, holding him back. "There's nothing you can do, Harry."
"Get him! Save him! He's only just gone through!"
"It's too late, Harry."
"We can still reach him!"
Harry struggled hard and viciously, but Lupin would not let go. "There's nothing you can do, Harry. Nothing. He's gone."
Chapter 36. The Only One He Ever Feared.
"He hasn't gone!"
Harry yelled. He did not believe it. He would not believe it. Still, he fought Lupin with every bit of strength he had. Lupin did not understand. People hid behind that curtain. Harry had heard them whispering the first time he had entered the room. Sirius was hiding, simply lurking out of sight.
"Sirius!"
he bellowed.
"Sirius!"
"He can't come back, Harry," said Lupin, his voice breaking as he struggled to contain Harry. "He can't come back because he's
He is not dead!"
roared Harry.
"Sirius!"
There was movement going on around them, pointless bustling, the flashes of more spells. To Harry it was meaningless noise. The deflected curses flying past them did not matter. Nothing mattered except that Lupin should stop pretending that Sirius, who was standing feet from them behind that old curtain, was not going to emerge at any moment, shaking back his dark hair and eager to re-enter the battle. Lupin dragged Harry away from the dais. Harry, still staring at the archway, was angry at Sirius now for keeping him waiting. But some part of him realized, even as he fought to break free from Lupin, that Sirius had never kept him waiting before. Sirius had risked everything, always, to see Harry, to help him. If Sirius was not reappearing out of that archway when Harry was yelling for him as though his life depended on it, the only possible explanation was that he could not come back, that he really was. Dumbledore had most of the remaining Death Eaters grouped in the middle of the room, seemingly immobilized by invisible ropes. Mad-Eye Moody had crawled across the room to where Tonks lay and was attempting to revive her.
Behind the dais there were still flashes of light, grunts and cries. Kingsley had run forward to continue Sirius's duel with Bellatrix.
"Harry!"
Neville had slid down the stone benches one by one to the place where Harry stood. Harry was no longer struggling against Lupin, who maintained a precautionary grip on his arm nevertheless.
"Harry, I'm really sorry," said Neville.
His legs were still dancing uncontrollably.
"Was that bad? Was Sirius Black a friend of yours?"
Harry nodded. "Here," said Lupin quietly, and pointing his wand at Neville's legs, he said, "Finite." The spell was lifted. Neville's legs fell back to the floor and remained still. Lupin's face was pale.
Let's find the others. Where are they all, Neville?"
Lupin turned away from the archway as he spoke. It sounded as though every word was causing him pain.
"They're all back there," said Neville. "A braid attacked Rod, but I think he's all right, and Hermione's unconscious. But we could feel a pulse."
There was a loud bang and a yell from behind the dais. Harry saw Kingsley hit the ground, yelling in pain. Bellatrix Lestrange turned tail and ran as Dumbledore whipped around. He aimed a spell at her, but she deflected it. She was halfway up the steps now.
"Harry, no!"
cried Lupin, but Harry had already ripped his arm from Lupin's slackened grip.
"She killed Sirius!" bellowed Harry. "She killed him! I'll kill her!"
And he was off, scrambling up the stone benches. People were shouting behind him, but he did not care. The hem of Bellatrix's robes whipped out of sight ahead, and they were back in the room where the brains were swimming. She aimed a curse over her shoulder. The tank rose into the air and tipped. Harry was deluged in the foul-smelling potion within. The brains slipped and slid over him and began spinning their long-coloured tentacles, but he shouted, "Wingardium Leviosa!" and they flew off him up into the air. Slipping and sliding, he ran on towards the door. He leapt over Luna, who was groaning on the floor, past Ginny, who said, "Harry, what?" past Ron, who giggled feebly, and Hermione, who was still unconscious. He wrenched open the door into the circular black hall and saw Bellatrix disappearing through a door on the other side of the room. Beyond her was the corridor leading back to the lifts. He ran, but she had slammed the door behind her, and the walls were already rotating. Once more, he was surrounded by streaks of blue light from the whirling candelabra.
"Where's the exit?"
he shouted desperately as the wall rumbled to a halt again.
"Where's the way out?"
The room seemed to have been waiting for him to ask. The door right behind him flew open, and the corridor towards the lifts stretched ahead of him, torchlit and empty. He ran. He could hear a lift clattering ahead. He sprinted up the passageway, swung around the corner, and slammed his fist onto the button to call a second lift. It jangled and banged lower and lower. The grills slid open, and Harry dashed inside, now hammering the button marked Atrium. The doors slid shut, and he was rising. He forced his way out of the lift before the grills were fully open and looked around. Bellatrix was almost at the telephone lift at the other end of the hall, but she looked back as he sprinted towards her and aimed another spell at him. He dodged behind the fountain of magical brethren. The spell zoomed past him and hit the wrought gold gates at the other end of the atrium so that they rang like bells. There were no more footsteps. She had stopped running. He crouched behind the statues, listening.
Come out, little Harry,"
she called in her mock baby voice, which echoed off the polished wooden floors.
"What did you come after me for, then? I thought you were here to avenge my dear cousin."
"I am," shouted Harry, and a score of ghostly Harrys seemed to chorus, "I am! I am! I am!" all around the room.
"Ah, did you love him, little baby Potter?"
Hatred rose in Harry such as he had never known before. He flung himself out from behind the fountain and bellowed, "Crucio!" Bellatrix screamed. The spell had knocked her off her feet, but she did not writhe and shriek with pain as Neville had. She was already back on her feet, breathless, no longer laughing. Harry dodged behind the golden fountain again. Her counterspell hit the head of the handsome wizard, which was blown off and landed 20 feet away, gouging long scratches into the wooden floor.
"Never used an unforgivable curse before, have you, boy?" she yelled.
She had abandoned her baby voice now.
"You need to mean them, Potter. You need to really want to cause pain, to enjoy it. Righteous anger won't hurt me for long. I'll show you how it is done, shall I? I'll give you a lesson."
Harry was edging around the fountain on the other side when she screamed,
"Crucio!"
And he was forced to duck down again as the centaur's arm, holding its bow, span off and landed with a crash on the floor a short distance from the golden wizard's head.
"Potter, you cannot win against me," she cried.
He could hear her moving to the right, trying to get a clear shot of him. He backed around the statue away from her, crouching behind the centaur's legs, his head level with the house elf's.
"I was and am the Dark Lord's most loyal servant. I learned the dark arts from him, and I know spells of such power that you, pathetic little boy, can never hope to compete." "Stupefy!" yelled Harry.
He had edged right around to where the goblin stood beaming up at the now headless wizard and taken aim at her back as she peered around the fountain. She reacted so fast he barely had time to duck.
"Protego!"
The jet of red light, his own stunning spell, bounced back at him. Harry scrambled back behind the fountain and one of the goblin's ears went flying across the room.
"Potter, I'm going to give you one chance," shouted Bellatrix. "Give me the prophecy. Roll it out towards me now, and I may spare your life."
"Well, you're going to have to kill me, because it's gone," Harry roared.
And as he shouted it, pain seared across his forehead. His scar was on fire again, and he felt a surge of fury that was quite unconnected with his own rage.
"And he knows," said Harry, with a mad laugh to match Bellatrix's own. "Your dear old mate Voldemort knows it's gone. He's not going to be happy with you, is he?" "What? What do you mean?" she cried,
and for the first time there was fear in her voice.
"The prophecy smashed when I was trying to get Neville up the steps. What do you think Voldemort'll say about that, then?"
His scar seared and burned. The pain of it was making his eyes stream.
"Liar!"
she shrieked, but he could hear the terror behind the anger now.
"You've got it, Potter, and you will give it to me! Axio prophecy! Axio prophecy!"
Harry laughed again, because he knew it would incense her. The pain building in his head so badly he thought his skull might burst. He waved his empty hand from behind the one-eared goblin and withdrew it quickly as she sent another jet of green light flying at him.
"Nothing there," he shouted. "Nothing to summon. It smashed, and nobody heard what it said. Tell your boss that." "No!" she screamed. "It isn't true. You're lying. Master, I tried. I tried. Do not punish me."
"Don't waste your breath,"
yelled Harry, his eyes screwed up against the pain in his scar, now more terrible than ever.
"He can't hear you from here."
"Can't I, Potter?"
said a high, cold voice. Harry opened his eyes. Tall, thin, and black-hooded, his terrible snake-like face white and gaunt, his scarlet, slit-pupilled eyes staring. Lord Voldemort had appeared in the middle of the hall, his wand pointing at Harry, who stood frozen, quite unable to move.
"So, you smashed my prophecy,"
said Voldemort softly, staring at Harry with those pitiless red eyes.
"No, Bella, he is not lying. I see the truth looking at me from within his worthless mind. Months of preparation, months of effort, and my Death Eaters have let Harry Potter thwart me again.
Master, I'm sorry, I knew not. I was fighting the Animagus Black.
Sobbed Bellatrix, flinging herself down at Voldemort's feet as he paced slowly nearer.
"Master, you should know."
"Be quiet, Bella," said Voldemort dangerously. "I shall deal with you in a moment. Do you think I have entered the Ministry of Magic to hear your snivelling apologies?"
"But, Master, he is here. He is below."
Voldemort paid no attention.
"I have nothing more to say to you, Potter," he said quietly. "You have irked me too often for too long. Avada Kedavra!"
Harry had not even opened his mouth to resist. His mind was blank, his wand pointing uselessly at the floor. But the headless golden statue of the wizard in the fountain had sprung alive, leaping from its plinth to land with a crash on the floor between Harry and Voldemort. The spell merely glanced off its chest as the statue flung out its arms to protect Harry.
"What?" cried Voldemort, staring around.
And then he breathed,
"Dumbledore."
Harry looked behind him, his heart pounding. Dumbledore was standing in front of the golden gates. Voldemort raised his wand, and another jet of green light streaked at Dumbledore, who turned and was gone in a whirling of his cloak. Next second, he had reappeared behind Voldemort and waved his wand towards the remnants of the fountain. The other statues sprang to life. The statue of the witch ran at Bellatrix, who screamed and sent spells streaming uselessly off its chest before it dived at her, pinning her to the floor. Meanwhile, the goblin and the house elf scuttled towards the fireplaces set along the wall, and the one-armed centaur galloped at Voldemort, who vanished and reappeared beside the pool. The headless statue thrust Harry backwards, away from the fight, as Dumbledore advanced on Voldemort, and the golden centaur cantered around them both.
"It was foolish to come here tonight, Tom," said Dumbledore calmly. "The Aurors are on their way."
"By which time I shall be gone, and you will be dead," spat Voldemort.
He sent another killing curse at Dumbledore, but missed, instead hitting the security guard's desk, which burst into flame. Dumbledore flicked his own wand. The force of the spell that emanated from it was such that Harry, though shielded by his golden guard, felt his hair stand on end as it passed. And this time Voldemort was forced to conjure a shining silver shield out of thin air to deflect it. The spell, whatever it was, caused no visible damage to the shield, though a deep, gong-like note reverberated from it, an oddly chilling sound.
"You do not seek to kill me, Dumbledore," called Voldemort, his scarlet eyes narrowed over the top of the shield. "Above such brutality, are you?"
"We both know that there are other ways of destroying a man, Tom," Dumbledore said calmly, continuing to walk towards Voldemort as though he had not a fear in the world, as though nothing had happened to interrupt his stroll up the hall. "Merely taking your life would not satisfy me, I admit."
"There is nothing worse than death, Dumbledore," snarled Voldemort.
"You are quite wrong,"
said Dumbledore, still closing in upon Voldemort, and speaking as lightly as though they were discussing the matter over drinks. Harry felt scared to see him walking along, undefended, shieldless. He wanted to cry out a warning, but his headless guard kept shunting him backwards towards the wall, blocking his every attempt to get out from behind it. Indeed, your failure to understand that there are things much worse than death has always been your greatest weakness. Another jet of green light flew from behind the silver shield. This time it was the one-armed centaur, galloping in front of Dumbledore, that took the blast and shattered into 100 pieces. But before the fragments had even hit the floor, Dumbledore had drawn back his wand and waved it as though brandishing a whip. A long, thin flame flew from the tip. It wrapped itself around Voldemort, shield and all. For a moment it seemed Dumbledore had won. But then the fiery rope became a serpent, which relinquished its hold on Voldemort at once and turned, hissing furiously, to face Dumbledore. Voldemort vanished. The snake reared from the floor, ready to strike. There was a burst of flame in midair above Dumbledore, just as Voldemort reappeared, standing on the plinth in the middle of the pool where so recently the 5 statues had stood.
"Look out!"
Harry yelled. But even as he shouted, another jet of green light flew at Dumbledore from Voldemort's wand, and the snake struck. Forks swooped down in front of Dumbledore, opened his beak wide, and swallowed the jet of green light whole. He burst into flame and fell to the floor, small, wrinkled, and flightless. At the same moment, Dumbledore brandished his wand in one long, fluid movement. The snake, which had been an instant from sinking its fangs into him, flew high into the air and vanished in a wisp of dark smoke. And the water in the pool rose up and covered Voldemort like a cocoon of molten glass. For a few seconds, Voldemort was visible only as a dark, rippling, faceless figure, shimmering and indistinct upon the plinth, clearly struggling to throw off the suffocating mass. Then he was gone, and the water fell with a crash back into its pool, slopping wildly over the sides, drenching the polished floor.
"Master!"
screamed Bellatrix. Sure it was over. Sure Voldemort had decided to flee, Harry made to run out from behind his statue guard, but Dumbledore bellowed,
"Stay where you are, Harry!"
For the first time, Dumbledore sounded frightened. Harry could not see why. The hall was quite empty, but for themselves, the sobbing Bellatrix still trapped under the witch statue, and the baby phoenix Forks croaking feebly on the floor. Then Harry's scar burst open, and he knew he was dead. It was pain beyond imagining, pain past endurance. He was gone from the hall. He was locked in the coils of a creature with red eyes, so tightly bound that Harry did not know where his body ended and the creature's began. They were fused together, bound by pain, and there was no escape. And when the creature spoke, it used Harry's mouth, so that in his agony he felt his jaw move.
"Kill me now, Dumbledore!"
Blinded and dying, every part of him screaming for release, Harry felt the creature use him again.
"If death is nothing, Dumbledore, kill the boy!"
"Let the pain stop," thought Harry. "Let him kill us. End it, Dumbledore. Death is nothing compared to this. And I'll see Sirius again." And as Harry's heart filled with emotion, the creature's coils loosened. The pain was gone. Harry was lying face down on the floor, his glasses gone, shivering as though he lay upon ice, not wood. And there were voices echoing through the hall, more voices than there should have been. Harry opened his eyes, saw his glasses lying by the heel of the headless statue that had been guarding him, but which now lay flat on its back, cracked and immobile. He put them on and raised his head a little to find Dumbledore's crooked nose inches from his own. "Are you all right, Harry?"
"Yes," said Harry, shaking so violently he could not hold his head up properly. "Yeah, I'm... Where's Voldemort? Where... Who are all these... What's..."
The atrium was full of people. The floor was reflecting the emerald green flames that had burst into life in all the fireplaces along one wall, and streams of witches and wizards were emerging from them. As Dumbledore pulled him back to his feet, Harry saw the tiny gold statues of the house elf and the goblin leading a stunned-looking Cornelius Fudge forward.
"He was there!"
shouted a scarlet-robed man with a ponytail, who was pointing at a pile of golden rubble on the other side of the hall, where Bellatrix had lain trapped only moments before.
"I saw him, Mr. Fudge. I swear it was you-know-who. He grabbed a woman and disapparated."
"I know, Williamson, I know. I saw him too," gibbered Fudge,
who was wearing pyjamas under his pinstriped cloak and was gasping as though he had just run miles.
"Merlin's beard! Here! Here! In the Ministry of Magic! Great heavens above! It doesn't seem possible! My word! How can this be?"
"If you proceed downstairs into the Department of Mysteries, Cornelius," said Dumbledore, apparently satisfied that Harry was all right, and walking forwards so that the newcomers realized he was there for the first time. A few of them raised their wands, others simply looked amazed. The statues of the elf and goblin applauded, and Fudge jumped so much that his slipper-clad feet left the floor. "You will find several escaped Death Eaters contained in the Death Chamber, bound by an anti-disapparation jinx, and awaiting your decision as to what to do with them."
"Dumbledore!" gasped Fudge, beside himself with amazement. "You here? I...
He looked wildly around at the auras he had brought with him, and it could not have been clearer that he was in half a mind to cry, "Seize him!"
"Cornelius, I am ready to fight your men and win again," said Dumbledore in a thunderous voice. "But a few minutes ago you saw proof with your own eyes that I have been telling you the truth for a year. Lord Voldemort has returned. You have been chasing the wrong man for 12 months, and it is time you listened to sense."
"I don't... Well..."
blustered Fudge, looking around as though hoping someone was going to tell him what to do. When nobody did, he said,
"Very well. Dawlish, Williamson, go down to the Department of Mysteries and see Dumbledore. You will need to tell me exactly. The Fountain of Magical Brethren. What happened?"
he added in a kind of whimper, staring around at the floor, where the remains of the statues of the witch, wizard and centaur now lay scattered. "We can discuss that after I have sent Harry back to Hogwarts," said Dumbledore.
"Harry? Harry Potter?"
Fudge span around and stared at Harry, who was still standing against the wall beside the fallen statue that had guarded him during Dumbledore and Voldemort's duel.
"He here?" said Fudge. "Why, what's all this about?"
"I shall explain everything," repeated Dumbledore, "when Harry is back at school." He walked away from the pool to the place where the golden wizard's head lay on the floor. He pointed his wand at it and muttered, "Portus." The head glowed blue and trembled noisily against the wooden floor for a few seconds, then became still once more.
"Now, see here, Dumbledore," said Fudge,
as Dumbledore picked up the head and walked back to Harry carrying it.
"You haven't got authorization for that portkey. You can't do things like that right in front of the Minister for Magic. You...
His voice faltered as Dumbledore surveyed him magisterially over his half-moon spectacles. "You will give the order to remove Dolores Umbridge from Hogwarts," said Dumbledore. "You will tell your aurors to stop searching for my Care of Magical Creatures teacher, so that he can return to work.
I will give you...
Dumbledore pulled a watch with 12 hands from his pocket and glanced at it.
30 minutes of my time tonight, in which I think we shall be more than able to cover the important points of what has happened here. After that, I shall need to return to my school. If you need more help from me, you are, of course, more than welcome to contact me at Hogwarts. Letters addressed to the headmaster will find me.
Fudge goggled worse than ever. His mouth was open, and his round face grew pinker under his rumpled grey hair. Dumbledore turned his back on him. Take this portkey, Harry. He held out the golden head of the statue, and Harry placed his hand on it, past caring what he did next or where he went.
I shall see you in 30 minutes, said Dumbledore quietly. 1, 2, 3.
Harry felt the familiar sensation of a hook being jerked behind his navel. The polished wooden floor was gone from beneath his feet. The atrium, Fudge, and Dumbledore had all disappeared, and he was flying forwards in a whirlwind of colour and sound. Chapter 37 The Lost Prophecy. Harry's feet hit solid ground. His knees buckled a little, and the golden wizard's head fell with a resounding clunk to the floor. He looked around and saw that he had arrived in Dumbledore's office. Everything seemed to have repaired itself during the headmaster's absence. The delicate silver instruments stood once more on the spindle-legged tables, puffing and whirring serenely. The portraits of the headmasters and headmistresses were snoozing in their frames, heads lolling back in armchairs or against the edge of the picture. Harry looked through the window. There was a cool line of pale green along the horizon. Dawn was approaching. The silence and the stillness, broken only by the occasional grunt or snuffle of a sleeping portrait, was unbearable to him. If his surroundings could have reflected the feelings inside him, the pictures would have been screaming in pain. He walked around the quiet, beautiful office, breathing quickly, trying not to think. But he had to think. There was no escape. It was his fault Sirius had died. It was all his fault. If he, Harry, had not been stupid enough to fall for Voldemort's trick, if he had not been so convinced that what he had seen in his dream was real, if he had only opened his mind to the possibility that Voldemort was, as Hermione had said, banking on Harry's love of playing the hero. It was unbearable. He would not think about it. He could not stand it. There was a terrible hollow inside him he did not want to feel or examine. A dark hole where Sirius had been, where Sirius had vanished. He did not want to have to be alone with that great, silent space. He could not stand it. A picture behind him gave a particularly loud, grunting snore, and a cool voice said, "Ah, Harry Potter!" Phineas Nigellus gave a long yawn, stretching his arms as he watched Harry with shrewd, narrow eyes. "And what brings you here in the early hours of the morning?" said Phineas eventually. "This office is supposed to be barred to all but the rightful headmaster. Or has Dumbledore sent you here? Oh, don't tell me." He gave another shuddering yawn. "Another message from my worthless great-great-grandson?" Harry could not speak. Phineas Nigellus did not know that Sirius was dead. But Harry could not tell him. To say it aloud would be to make it final, absolute, irretrievable. A few more of the portraits had stirred now. Terror of being interrogated made Harry stride across the room and seize the doorknob. It would not turn. He was shut in. "I hope this means," said the corpulent, red-nosed wizard who hung on the wall behind the headmaster's desk, "that Dumbledore will soon be back among us." Harry turned. The wizard was eyeing him with great interest. Harry nodded. He tugged again on the doorknob behind his back, but it remained immovable.
"Oh, good," said the wizard. "It has been very dull without him. Very dull indeed."
He settled himself on the throne-like chair on which he had been painted, and smiled benignly upon Harry.
"Dumbledore thinks very highly of you, as I'm sure you know," he said comfortably. "Oh, yes, holds you in great esteem."
The guilt filling the whole of Harry's chest like some monstrous, weighty parasite now writhed and squirmed. Harry could not stand this. He could not stand being himself any more. He had never felt more trapped inside his own head and body, never wished so intensely that he could be somebody, anybody else. The empty fireplace burst into emerald green flame, making Harry leap away from the door, staring at the man spinning inside the grate. As Dumbledore's tall form unfolded itself from the fire, the wizards and witches on the surrounding walls jerked awake, many of them giving cries of welcome.
"Thank you," said Dumbledore softly.
He did not look at Harry at first, but walked over to the perch beside the door and withdrew from an inside pocket of his robes the tiny, ugly, featherless forks, whom he placed gently on the tray of soft ashes beneath the golden post where the full-grown forks usually stood.
"Well, Harry," said Dumbledore, finally turning away from the baby bird, "you will be pleased to hear that none of your fellow students are going to suffer lasting damage from the night's events."
Harry tried to say, "Good," but no sound came out. It seemed to him that Dumbledore was reminding him of the amount of damage he had caused, and although Dumbledore was for once looking at him directly, and although his expression was kindly rather than accusatory, Harry could not bear to meet his eyes.
"Madam Pomfrey is patching everybody up," said Dumbledore. "Nymphadora Tonks may need to spend a little time in St. Mungo's, but it seems she will make a full recovery."
Harry contented himself with nodding at the carpet, which was growing lighter as the sky outside grew paler. He was sure all the portraits around the room were listening eagerly to every word Dumbledore spoke, wondering where Dumbledore and Harry had been, and why there had been injuries.
"I know how you're feeling, Harry," said Dumbledore very quietly.
"No, you don't!" said Harry, and his voice was suddenly loud and strong. White-hot anger leapt inside him. Dumbledore knew nothing about his feelings.
"You see, Dumbledore," said Phineas Nigellus slyly, "never try to understand the students. They hate it. They would much rather be tragically misunderstood, wallow in self-pity, stew in their own—"
"That's enough, Phineas," said Dumbledore. Harry turned his back on Dumbledore and stared determinedly out of the window. He could see the Quidditch stadium in the distance. Sirius had appeared there once, disguised as the shaggy black dog, so he could watch Harry play. He had probably come to see whether Harry was as good as James had been. Harry had never asked him.
"There is no shame in what you are feeling, Harry," said Dumbledore's voice. "On the contrary, the fact that you can feel pain like this is your greatest strength."
Harry felt the white-hot anger lick his insides, blazing in the terrible emptiness, filling him with the desire to hurt Dumbledore for his calmness and his empty words.
"My greatest strength, is it?" said Harry,
his voice shaking as he stared out at the Quidditch stadium, no longer seeing it.
"You haven't got a clue. You don't know."
"What don't I know?" asked Dumbledore calmly. It was too much. Harry turned around, shaking with rage.
"I don't want to talk about how I feel, all right?"
"Harry, suffering like this proves you are still a man.
This pain is part of being human.
Then I don't want to be human,
Harry roared, and he seized the delicate silver instrument from the spindle-legged table beside him and flung it across the room. It shattered into 100 tiny pieces against the wall. Several of the pictures let out yells of anger and fright, and the portrait of Armando Dippet said,
"Really?" "I don't care,"
Harry yelled at them, snatching up a lunoscope and throwing it into the fireplace.
"I've had enough. I've seen enough. I want out. I want it to end. I don't care any more."
He seized the table on which the silver instrument had stood and threw that too. It broke apart on the floor, and the legs rolled in different directions.
"You do care," said Dumbledore.
He had not flinched or made a single move to stop Harry demolishing his office. His expression was calm, almost detached.
"You care so much, you feel as though you will bleed to death with the pain of it."
"I don't!"
Harry screamed, so loudly that he felt his throat might tear. And for a second he wanted to rush at Dumbledore and break him too, shatter that calm old face, shake him, hurt him, make him feel some tiny part of the horror inside himself.
"Oh, yes, you do," said Dumbledore, still more calmly. "You have now lost your mother, your father, and the closest thing to a parent you have ever known. Of course you care."
"You don't know how I feel!"
Harry roared.
"You standing there! You—"
But words were no longer enough. Smashing things was no more help. He wanted to run. He wanted to keep running and never look back. He wanted to be somewhere he could not see the clear blue eyes staring at him, that hatefully calm old face. He ran to the door, seized the doorknob again, and wrenched at it. But the door would not open. Harry turned back to Dumbledore.
"Let me out," he said.
He was shaking from head to foot.
"No," said Dumbledore simply.
For a few seconds they stared at each other.
"Let me out," Harry said again.
"No," Dumbledore repeated.
"If you don't, if you keep me in here, if you don't let me—"
"By all means continue destroying my possessions," said Dumbledore serenely. "I dare say I have too many."
He walked around his desk and sat down behind it, watching Harry.
"Let me out," Harry said yet again, in a voice that was cold and almost as calm as Dumbledore's.
"Not until I have had my say," said Dumbledore.
Do you think I want to... Do you think I give a... I don't care what you've got to say," Harry roared. "I don't want to hear anything you've got to say."
"You will," said Dumbledore steadily, "because you are not nearly as angry with me as you ought to be. If you are to attack me, as I know you are close to doing, I would like to have thoroughly earned it."
"What are you talking?"
"It is my fault that Sirius died," said Dumbledore clearly. "Or should I say, almost entirely my fault. I will not be so arrogant as to claim responsibility for the whole. Sirius was a brave, clever, and energetic man, and such men are not usually content to sit at home in hiding while they believe others to be in danger. Nevertheless, you should never have believed for an instant that there was any necessity for you to go to the Department of Mysteries tonight. If I had been open with you, Harry, as I should have been, you would have known a long time ago that Voldemort might try and lure you to the Department of Mysteries, and you would never have been tricked into going there tonight, and Sirius would not have had to come after you. That blame lies with me, and with me alone." Harry was still standing with his hand on the doorknob, but was unaware of it. He was gazing at Dumbledore, hardly breathing, listening, yet barely understanding what he was hearing. "Please sit down," said Dumbledore. It was not an order, it was a request. Harry hesitated. then walked slowly across the room, now littered with silver cogs and fragments of wood, and took the seat facing Dumbledore's desk. "Am I to understand," said Phineas Nigellus slowly from Harry's left, "that my great-great-grandson, the last of the Blacks, is dead?" "Yes, Phineas," said Dumbledore. "I don't believe it," said Phineas brusquely. Harry turned his head in time to see Phineas marching out of his portrait, and knew that he had gone to visit his other painting in Grim Old Place. He would walk, perhaps, from portrait to portrait, calling for Sirius through the house. "Harry, I owe you an explanation," said Dumbledore, "an explanation of an old man's mistakes. For I see now that what I have done, and not done, with regard to you, bears all the hallmarks of the failings of age. Youth cannot know how age thinks and feels, but old men are guilty if they forget what it was to be young, and I seem to have forgotten lately." The sun was rising properly now. There was a rim of dazzling orange visible over the mountains, and the sky above it was colourless and bright. The light fell upon Dumbledore, upon the silver of his eyebrows and beard, upon the lines gouged deeply into his face. "I guessed 15 years ago," said Dumbledore, "when I saw the scar on your forehead, what it might mean. I guessed that it might be the sign of a connection forged between you and Voldemort." "You've told me this before, Professor," said Harry bluntly. He did not care about being rude. He did not care about anything very much any more. "Yes," said Dumbledore apologetically. "Yes, but you see, it is necessary to start with your scar. For it became apparent, shortly after you rejoined the magical world, that I was correct, and that your scar was giving you warnings when Voldemort was close to you, or else feeling powerful emotion." "I know," said Harry wearily. "And this ability of yours to detect Voldemort's presence, even when he is disguised, and to know what he is feeling when his emotions are roused, has become more and more pronounced since Voldemort returned to his own body and his full powers." Harry did not bother to nod. He knew all of this already. "More recently," said Dumbledore, "I became concerned that Voldemort might realize that this connection between you exists. Sure enough, there came a time when you entered so far into his mind and thoughts that he sensed your presence. I'm speaking, of course, of the night when you witnessed the attack on Mr. Weasley." "Yeah, Snape told me," Harry muttered. "Professor Snape, Harry," Dumbledore corrected him quietly. "But did you not wonder why it was not I who explained this to you? Why I did not teach you occlumency? Why I had not so much as looked at you for months?" Harry looked up. He could see now that Dumbledore looked sad and tired. "Yeah," Harry mumbled. "Yeah, I wondered." "You see," Dumbledore continued, "I believed it could not be long before Voldemort attempted to force his way into your mind, to manipulate and misdirect your thoughts, and I was not eager to give him more incentives to do so. I was sure that if he realized that our relationship was, or had ever been, closer than that of headmaster and pupil, he would seize his chance to use you as a means to spy on me. I feared the uses to which he would put you, the possibility that he might try and possess you. Harry, I believe I was right to think that Voldemort would have made use of you in such a way. On those rare occasions when we had close contact, I thought I saw a shadow of him stir behind your eyes." Harry remembered the feeling that a dormant snake had risen in him, ready to strike, in those moments when he and Dumbledore had made eye contact. "Voldemort's aim in possessing you, as he demonstrated tonight, would not have been my destruction. It would have been yours. He hoped, when he possessed you briefly a short while ago, that I would sacrifice you in the hope of killing him. So, you see, I have been trying, in distancing myself from you, to protect you, Harry. An old man's mistake. He sighed deeply. Harry was letting the words wash over him. He would have been so interested to know all this a few months ago, but now it was meaningless compared to the gaping chasm inside him that was the loss of Sirius. None of it mattered. "Sirius told me you felt Voldemort awake inside you the very night that you had the vision of Arthur Weasley's attack. I knew at once that my worst fears were correct. Voldemort had realized he could use you. In an attempt to arm you against Voldemort's assaults on your mind, I arranged occlumency lessons with Professor Snape." He paused. Harry watched the sunlight, which was sliding slowly across the polished surface of Dumbledore's desk, illuminate a silver inkpot and a handsome scarlet quill. Harry could tell that the portraits all around them were awake and listening raptly to Dumbledore's explanation. He could hear the occasional rustle of robes, the slight clearing of a throat. Phineas Nigellus had still not returned. "Professor Snape discovered," Dumbledore resumed, "that you had been dreaming about the door to the Department of Mysteries for months. Voldemort, of course, had been obsessed with the possibility of hearing the prophecy ever since he regained his body, and as he dwelled on the door, so did you, though you did not know what it meant. And then you saw Rookwood, who worked in the Department of Mysteries before his arrest, telling Voldemort what we had known all along, that the prophecies held in the Ministry of Magic are heavily protected. Only the people to whom they refer can lift them from the shelves without suffering madness. In this case, either Voldemort himself would have to enter the Ministry of Magic and risk revealing himself at last, or else you would have to take it for him. It became a matter of even greater urgency that you should master occlumency." "But I didn't," muttered Harry. He said it aloud to try and ease the dead weight of guilt inside him. A confession must surely relieve some of the terrible pressure squeezing his heart. "I didn't practice. I didn't bother. I could have stopped myself having those dreams. Hermione kept telling me to do it. If I had, he'd never have been able to show me where to go. And Sirius wouldn't... Something was erupting inside Harry's head, a need to justify himself, to explain. "I tried to check he'd really taken Sirius. I went to Umbridge's office. I spoke to Creature in the fire, and he said Sirius wasn't there. He said he'd gone." "Creature lied," said Dumbledore calmly. "You are not his master. He could lie to you without even needing to punish himself. Creature intended you to go to the Ministry of Magic."
He sent me on purpose."
"Oh, yes. Creature, I am afraid, has been serving more than one master for months."
"How?" said Harry blankly. "He hasn't been out of Grimmauld Place for years."
"Creature seized his opportunity shortly before Christmas," said Dumbledore, "when Sirius, apparently, shouted at him to get out. He took Sirius at his word, and interpreted this as an order to leave the house. He went to the only black family member, for whom he had any respect, left. Black's cousin Narcissa, sister of Bellatrix, and wife of Lucius Malfoy."
"How do you know all this?" Harry said. His heart was beating very fast. He felt sick. He remembered worrying about Creature's odd absence over Christmas, remembered him turning up again in the attic.
"Creature told me last night," said Dumbledore. "You see, when you gave Professor Snape that cryptic warning, he realized that you had had a vision of Sirius trapped in the bowels of the Department of Mysteries. He, like you, attempted to contact Sirius at once. I should explain that members of the Order of the Phoenix have more reliable methods of communicating than the fire in Dolores Umbridge's office. Professor Snape found that Sirius was alive and safe in Grimmauld Place. When, however, you did not return from your trip into the forest with Dolores Umbridge,
Professor Snape grew worried that you still believed Sirius to be a captive of Lord Voldemort's. He alerted certain Order members at once. Dumbledore heaved a great sigh and continued. Alastair Moody, Nymphadora Tonks, Kingsley Shacklebolt, and Remus Lupin were at headquarters when he made contact. All agreed to go to your aid at once. Professor Snape requested that Sirius remain behind, as he needed somebody to remain at headquarters to tell me what had happened, for I was due there at any moment. In the meantime, he, Professor Snape, intended to search the forest for you. But Sirius did not wish to remain behind while the others went to search for you. He delegated to Creature the task of telling me what had happened. And so it was that when I arrived in Grimald Place shortly after they had all left for the Ministry, it was the elf who told me, laughing fit to burst, where Sirius had gone. "He was laughing," said Harry in a hollow voice. "Oh, yes," said Dumbledore. "You see, Creature was not able to betray us totally. He is not secret keeper for the Order. He could not give the Malfoys our whereabouts, or tell them any of the Order's confidential plans that he had been forbidden to reveal. He was bound by the enchantments of his kind, which is to say that he could not disobey a direct order from his master, Sirius. But he gave Narcissa information of the sort that is very valuable to Voldemort, yet must have seemed much too trivial for Sirius to think of banning him from repeating it."
"Like what?" said Harry.
"Like the fact that the person Sirius cared most about in the world was you," said Dumbledore quietly. "Like the fact that you were coming to regard Sirius as a mixture of father and brother. Voldemort knew already, of course, that Sirius was in the Order, and that you knew where he was, but Creature's information made him realize that the one person for whom you would go to any length to rescue was Sirius Black." Harry's lips were cold and numb.
"So, when I asked Creature if Sirius was there last night, the Malfoys, undoubtedly on Voldemort's instructions, had told him he must find a way of keeping Sirius out of the way once you had seen the vision of Sirius being tortured. Then, if you decided to check whether Sirius was at home or not, Creature would be able to pretend he was not. Creature injured Buckbeak the Hippogriff yesterday, and at the moment when you made your appearance in the fire, Sirius was upstairs tending to him." There seemed to be very little air in Harry's lungs. His breathing was quick and shallow.
"And Creature told you all this, and laughed," he croaked.
"He did not wish to tell me," said Dumbledore, "but I am a sufficiently accomplished legilimens myself to know when I am being lied to, and I persuaded him to tell me the full story before I left for the Department of Mysteries."
"And," whispered Harry, his hands curled in cold fists on his knees,
"and Hermione kept telling us to be nice to him."
"She was quite right, Harry," said Dumbledore. "I warned Sirius when we adopted 12 Grimald Place as our headquarters that Creature must be treated with kindness and respect. I also told him that Creature could be dangerous to us. I do not think Sirius took me very seriously, or that he ever saw Creature as a being with feelings as acute as a human's."
"Don't you blame... don't you talk about Sirius like..."
Harry's breath was constricted. He could not get the words out properly, but the rage that had subsided briefly flared in him again. He would not let Dumbledore criticize Sirius.
"Creature's a lying foul. He deserved..."
"Creature is what he has been made by wizards, Harry," said Dumbledore.
"Yes, he is to be pitied. His existence has been as miserable as your friend Dobby's. He was forced to do Sirius's bidding because Sirius was the last of the family to which he was enslaved. But he felt no true loyalty to him. And whatever Creature's faults, it must be admitted that Sirius did nothing to make Creature's lot easier."
"Don't talk about Sirius like that!"
Harry yelled. He was on his feet again, furious, ready to fly at Dumbledore, who had plainly not understood Sirius at all, how brave he was, how much he had suffered.
"What about Snape?"
Harry spat.
"You're not talking about him, are you? When I told him Voldemort had Sirius, he just sneered at me as usual."
"Harry, you know Professor Snape had no choice but to pretend not to take you seriously in front of Dolores Umbridge," said Dumbledore steadily. "But as I have explained, he informed the Order as soon as possible about what you had said. It was he who deduced where you had gone when you did not return from the forest. It was he, too, who gave Professor Umbridge fake Veritaserum when she was attempting to force you to tell her Sirius's whereabouts." Harry disregarded this. He felt a savage pleasure in blaming Snape. It seemed to be easing his own sense of dreadful guilt, and he wanted to hear Dumbledore agree with him.
Snape goaded Sirius about staying in the house. He made out Sirius was a coward.
Sirius was much too old and clever to have allowed such feeble taunts to hurt him, said Dumbledore.
Snape stopped giving me occlumency lessons, Harry snarled. He threw me out of his office.
I am aware of it, said Dumbledore heavily. I have already said that it was a mistake for me not to teach you myself, though I was sure at the time that nothing could have been more dangerous than to open your mind even further to Voldemort while in my presence.
Snape made it worse. My scar always hurt worse after lessons with him.
Harry remembered Ron's thoughts on the subjects and plunged on.
How do you know he wasn't trying to soften me up for Voldemort, make it easier for him to get inside my...
I trust Severus Snape, said Dumbledore simply. But I forgot, another old man's mistake, that some wounds run too deep for the healing. I thought Professor Snape could overcome his feelings about your father. I was wrong.
But that's okay, is it?
Yelled Harry, ignoring the scandalized faces and disapproving mutterings of the portraits on the walls.
It's okay for Snape to hate my dad, but it's not okay for Sirius to hate Creature.
Sirius did not hate Creature, said Dumbledore. He regarded him as a servant unworthy of much interest or notice. Indifference and neglect often do much more damage than outright dislike. The fountain we destroyed tonight told a lie. We wizards have mistreated and abused our fellows for too long, and we are now reaping our reward.
So Sirius deserved what he got, did he?
Harry yelled. I did not say that, nor will you ever hear me say it, Dumbledore replied quietly. Sirius was not a cruel man. He was kind to house elves in general. He had no love for Creature, because Creature was a living reminder of the home Sirius had hated.
Yeah, he did hate it, said Harry, his voice cracking, turning his back on Dumbledore and walking away.
The sun was bright inside the room now, and the eyes of all the portraits followed him as he walked, without realizing what he was doing, without seeing the office at all.
You made him stay shut up in that house, and he hated it. That's why he wanted to get out last night.
I was trying to keep Sirius alive, said Dumbledore quietly.
People don't like being locked up, Harry said furiously, rounding on him. You did it to me all last summer.
Dumbledore closed his eyes and buried his face in his long-fingered hands. Harry watched him, but this uncharacteristic sign of exhaustion or sadness or whatever it was from Dumbledore did not soften him. On the contrary, he felt even angrier that Dumbledore was showing signs of weakness. He had no business being weak when Harry wanted to rage and storm at him. Dumbledore lowered his hands and surveyed Harry through his half-moon glasses. "It is time," he said, "for me to tell you what I should have told you 5 years ago, Harry. Please sit down. I am going to tell you everything. I ask only a little patience. You will have your chance to rage at me, to do whatever you like, when I have finished. I will not stop you." Harry glared at him for a moment, then flung himself back into the chair opposite Dumbledore and waited.